Thank you for the introduction, Matt. Also, thank you very much for inviting me here. Also, to Lee Smolin for hospitality here. It's really a pleasure. This is my first time at the Pyramid Institute. And when I came in, it looked like the Google campus. I was really impressed. It's a beautiful institute you have. Okay, so the real title. I think the title that I submitted, I just took from our paper, which was called Quantum Phenomena Modeled by Interactions of Many Classical Worlds. It's a joint work. I should have written it. Yeah, I somehow forgot. It's a joint work with Michael Hall and Howard Wiseman from Griffith University in Australia. But since I know that, at least from the reputation of Perimeter Institute, I mean, I can discuss a lot of foundational questions here, and I don't immediately get beaten up like in some other faculties of theoretical physics. I would like to talk a little bit about also my motivation, or Howard's and Michael's and my motivation towards what I will present, like a kind of many worlds theory that reproduces quantum mechanics, basically from a classical force. And therefore, I think the title is more quantum mechanics and the wave function, or the meaning of the wave function. And the outline will be more or less like three parts. First is a little practitioner's perspective on quantum theory, maybe like we would learn from in a book. Then the second thing is I will say that I'll miss something that I call ontology, basically the relation between the mathematical objects in the theory and what is really their nature. There are versions of quantum theory which have a nice ontology, and one of these interpretations I will present. And starting from this interpretation, where it's really spelled out what mathematical object has which relation to some object in nature, I think we're allowed to ask the question, I mean, what is really the role of the wave function? What's the relation between the wave function and something that might be in nature, or something that might only be there mathematically? So without doubt, quantum mechanics is one of the fundamental columns of physics. I only put here general relativity, classical mechanics, quantum theory, string theory, and quantum gravity, and somehow also meant in the terms of quantum theory. So usually, I mean, at least when I was a student, people told me, okay, well, at large scales, we have general relativity, intermediate scales, we have classical mechanics, small scales, we have quantum mechanics. It's not so easy to buy that, and I also, as a student, I didn't buy that. And by now, I mean, there are many experiments, for example, the interference experiments or superposition experiments from the Zeilinger group in Vienna. Then the question how to incorporate quantum gravity into quantum theory. So it's not really a matter of scales, not in terms of how many particles are present, not in terms of what kind of length that we really consider. There's really not a very distinct borderline between all these theories. So one could ask, I mean, when should you prefer one theory over another? And that will lead us a little bit to the question that I want to pose about quantum theory. For example, as a practitioner, I mean, one could say quantum theoretic description is good when it's good. Okay, in some sense, I mean, when I have an experiment and I can predict some outcomes, or at least can give some arguments why these outcomes are actually there. So, but then the next question that one could ask is, I mean, now only related only in perspective of quantum theory. So what then is quantum theory really about? What is it that is so good predicting it? And if you look at the defining equations of quantum theory, you usually presented the Schrödinger equation. There's some mathematical objects, derivatives, operators, and so on. But there's the wave function, the psi of t. And I think it's a valid question to ask, what is it really that moves in the theory? I mean, we have sometimes you even call the quantum theory quantum mechanics. So something, mechanics is about motion somehow. Here the object that moves is psi of t, the wave function. And the question is, I mean, what really is that entity that moves in the theory? And there's a nice article published in 1990 by John S. Bell. And he is one of the subsection is called Why Not Look It Up in a Good Book. And Bell gave a couple of arguments why it's quite hard to answer this question from a good book. I mean, there are a couple of good books out, but usually quantum mechanics is introduced to the novice by in terms of some or in some axiomatic form. I mean, this I have copied it from a quite modern lecture in a quite respectable from a quite respectable institution, which will I not disclose. Okay, but usually, I mean, you read stuff like that in every book. I just wanted to make sure that this is also something that is actually taught nowadays. So one says the following things. One says, first, the state of a quantum system is represented by the wave function psi or by a ket psi. Observables are represented by Hermitian operators A that act on these kets, on these states. The only possible outcome of a measurement is the eigenvalue of the operator. The probability of measuring An can be given in terms of these scalar products, modulus squared. And after a measurement yielding An, the new state is a normalized projection, which you can write down like this. And usually the time evolution is ruled by the Schrödinger evolution or the Schrödinger equation. And I think this is a quite fitting comment if you see these postulates for the first time. I mean, Niels Bohr said once, for those who are not shocked when they first come across quantum theory, cannot possibly have understood it. So what are we shocked about? At least I can tell you what I was shocked about. And maybe really in a compressed form summarized here. And I think all these things that are underlined are part of some vocabulary that is somehow commonly used in books as if they were intrinsically clear. Okay, and they caused a lot of trees to be killed in quantum philosophy and so on and so forth. So let me maybe go through this list. So it's enumerated exactly in the same way as the postulates of quantum theory. So first, a system of what? Of particles, of fields, so what is really there? What are really the degrees of the stuff that we want to describe and encode in what we call the state of a system? The observables, so is that a thing that a human can experience, only humans, or also other parts of the universe? Then measurement, so do I have to look at the pointer in my lab, or is the pointer being there already enough for making some statement? So is there, for example, a one-to-one correspondence map between these Hermitian operators and experiments? Of course, we know that's not the case. Then probability. Is there something intrinsically stochastic about our, about nature? Or is it just an effective description of something that might be still deterministic? Or maybe are all possibilities realized, I mean, like in the many-world interpretation, but we just don't know in which world we live. And the next thing is, of course, when is after the measurement? Okay. So is that exactly the time when I look at the pointer? Does the collapse occur exactly then? And there's also a nice saying of the same article by Jonas Bell. So was the wave function of the world waiting to jump for thousands of millions of years until a single-celled living creature appeared? Or did it have to wait a little bit longer for some better qualified system, maybe with a PhD? Okay, I think that's a valid question to pose. And then the last postulate was that psi, actually the time evolution of psi is ruled by the Schrödinger equation. Since it is unitary and linear, it's clear that it contradicts, of course, the projection postulate number 5, and that leads to the Schrödinger's cat problem and so on and so forth. So I think these are valid questions to pose, at least I hope in the Perimeter Institute, I can pose these questions. So, and there's another nice comment that describes a little bit the situation. I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics, and that was in 65, so quite a deal later than the birth time of quantum mechanics. So again, after all these detour and all these things, or description of my little problems with the definition of what people teach to be quantum mechanics, the question remains, I mean, what is quantum theory really about? whether you work with these postulates or you have some different mind or another interpretation of quantum mechanics, what is the theory about? And I think the guiding, or at least for me, one of the guiding ideas in science is that you make up your mind that something in nature is really there, exists, and that you like to describe this. I mean, these ideas go back to Parmenides and are quite nicely, I think, captured also by this famous saying of Einstein, I like to think that the moon is there even when I'm not looking at it. So some things, so if that's your guiding idea to say, okay, let's come up with a quantum theory, with a version of it that really spells out what there is in nature and then gives some mathematics how to describe what there is and how it moves and changes in time. So one of the versions or interpretations of quantum theory that have a particularly precise and very simple ontology is Bohmian mechanics. So the ontology can be spelled out in this little sentence. There are n matter points, they have spatial relations with respect to each other, and those change. Okay, full stop. So what really is in nature is the matter points, the n matter points, for example. Okay, the mathematics are also not so difficult. Basically, you can write the change down in terms of the differential equation, that Q of t specifies the configuration of the n particles in, for example, three-dimensional space. So Q of t is then an entity that lives in configuration space R to the 3n. And Q of t is moved by a velocity field. This velocity field actually is a function of psi t itself and is evaluated as it's common, of course, at the position of the configuration. The velocity field is just given by, when you look at the Schrödinger equation, we know the Schrödinger equation has a flux conservation, a current conservation. So you take the current that you have from the Schrödinger equation, whatever the Hamiltonian here is, divided by the density, then you get something that has the unit of the velocity. If you take this to be your velocity field, then I would call the theory that you have Bohmian mechanics. So if you specify initial conditions, Q naught and psi naught, then there's a unique solution. Let's say if the initial conditions are sufficiently regular, then you can actually prove that there are solutions. And basically, then you could say there's nothing more to say. The particles at time t have the configuration qt, and that's what's going on in the world. So that's why I say here, in principle, nothing is left to say. Unfortunately, but I mean, this is something that is not a specialty of Bohmian mechanics, but that's the problem in any theory that is about the universe. Nothing is known about Q naught and psi naught, about the initial conditions. I mean, if you have an experiment, the things that you have under control are the little degrees of freedom that you have actually on your table. The rest of the universe is completely unknown to you. I mean, the information that we would need actually to find a trajectory, a Bohmian trajectory, for example, to do predictions with, are basically, or most of that data is not known. So the question arises, as in classical mechanics also, I mean, how do we do predictions or get to predictions of subsystems of the universe? So such a program can be carried out for Bohmian mechanics exactly in the way Boltzmann carried it out for statistical mechanics. So somehow the unknown initial data has to be replaced with something that allows us to compute at least a couple of trajectories. And if you replace it by random variables, which are distributed by some measure, some notion of what typically happens, that's why this measure is usually called a notion of typicality, then you can at least make probabilistic statements. It's a little bit the same, but for example, when we throw a stone, I mean, it flies on a parabola. If you deviate the initial conditions a little bit, I mean, it will be a very similar parabola. Okay, but if you flip a coin, okay, and deviate from the initial conditions of our first coin flip it only a little bit, could be a complete different outcome. So whenever the dynamics somehow are chaotic in the sense that little change in the initial conditions give a lot of change in the end. Then, I mean, we're very happily residing on a probabilistic description of that system, not really computing all the trajectories, but more or less only saying something like, in a typical universe, I mean, the numbers of tails and the number of heads are equal, at least if the repetitions are high enough of the experiment. So there's a principle that usually, at least in classical mechanics and Boltzmann's program, really tells you what the measure should be. And this principle is typicality doesn't change in time. What was typically at some time will be typical at some other time. And then we naturally go to a probabilistic description of the system, replacing our ignorance with these measures that we have on the initial conditions. And this typicality does not change principle. It's basically somehow with this principle you can identify the measure. And in Bohmian mechanics, this is identified basically by the following property that is usually referred to as equivariance. Basically, if we say if this measure, for example, here as a density is given at time zero by psi naught squared, if you then take the Bohmian flux, so the integrated velocity field basically to transport this measure to a different time, then this rho of t is given actually by psi t squared. Okay? So that this diagram commutes is usually called equivariance, and that really singles out a specific measure. It's not psi to the 4, it's psi to the 2. Okay. So this is a measure we could work with and at least try to come up with a probabilistic description of the subsystems. So in principle, everything is deterministic, but since we don't know the precise initial conditions, the best we can say is, I mean, replace it by random variables with a special measure, namely that measure that has this fulfills this principle of stationarity. And then actually we can talk about subsystems. So, I mean, I run through this just quickly because that's not really the point of my talk, but it shows a little bit, I mean, how precise you can be in Bohmian mechanics, and that after writing down the ontology and the defining equation, basically everything else that you have to do is mathematics. Mathematics is, of course, a lot simpler than physics. I'm allowed to say that because I'm in the mathematical department. Okay, so the configuration, if we split it up into degrees of freedom of the subsystem, degrees of freedom of the rest of the universe, and we also do the splitting here, for example, in the wave function, then we can write down the following definition. So we can say a subsystem x of t at time t has the effective wave function phi of t if and only if we can write the wave function as a product plus another function. And the wave functions here, the one wave function of the product and these omega orthogonal have macroscopically disjoint support in Y. And our actually conservation is such that we are in the support of this guy. So there should also be a T. Yeah. Okay. So again, I mean, this does not have to be fulfilled at all times, okay? But when it's fulfilled, then we say a subsystem has the effective effective wave function phi.
So what you mean by orthogonal there is disjoint support, or is it orthogonal with respect to some inner product?
Yeah, I mean that's basically the same. If you have disjoint support, then it's orthogonal. That's why I also I write
it. It could be orthogonal depending on the inner product. It could be orthogonal.
Yeah, so exactly, yeah. But I mean in this way. So usually think about, for example, Schrödinger's cat experiment. You have a pointer that points left or right, okay, and then you have a little subsystem that you actually measure, and you couple these two systems, okay? So you go on a configuration space where the pointer left and pointer right are so far apart macroscopically because the degrees of freedom are so large involved in those, that you actually can have a splitting of the wave function, for example, in two wave packets, which have a large distance in configuration space in between. So now if the particles would be in that packet, they would be guided by that wave packet. If the Bohmian particles would be in that wave packet, they would only be guided by this. And so effectively, if y of t could be the degrees of freedom of the pointer, and this could be an atom or some that a nucleon that decays. So if the particles are really in this support and these guys have this joint y support, then only this guy will be responsible for the dynamics. Okay, that's the definition of effective wave function.
Just to make sure I understand, yeah. So this is all done at fixed time. So you don't exclude it at some later time, these two parts interact.
Could mix again. Okay. However, if you think about an experiment, usually for quite some time, I mean, there won't be an interaction between x and y. So if y is the pointer, and I mean, after the measurement, in some sense, when it's clear that such a splitting, so after the measurement is really that time when the splitting exists exactly in this way, the Bohmian particles decided to be in one part of the configuration space, then we have the splitting. But of course, there could be an interaction between x and y, and they can become entangled again. And then, of course, the effective wave function doesn't exist anymore for the system. But usually in an experiment, you try to maximize at least in the time that you measure, like a period of time where you don't have this mixing anymore.
And does also this phi t then just satisfy the one particle Schrödinger equation?
Yeah, I'll come to this fact. So because, I mean, first, so if you want to say something about relative frequencies of the subsystem, we have to also get to a measure. Okay, we had this measure on the universe scale, this psi t squared. But we also have to get it, of course, on for the subsystem. And starting with this measure, you can actually prove that if you have in your one universe, so I'm not talking about an ensemble of universes, but you have one universe, but in that universe, you have an ensemble of experiments. For example, in a double slit, I know repetitive measurements of position of where the particle really hit the screen. Okay, then in this ensemble, the phi t squared distribution is exactly the distribution of your particles. That is now an ensemble measure. Okay, psi t squared was for the universe, or in some sense, all possible universes. Whereas this phi t squared gives you statistics in one universe where you do an ensemble of experiments. So in some sense, you can equally formulate this theorem as Born rule holds whenever the subsystem has the effective wave function. And then the reason why I show this is just to show you, in Bohmian mechanics, you can make the collapse of the wave function, the time after the measurement, and so on and so forth, completely mathematically precise. Namely, I mean, you have a collapse whenever like a phi t exists. Okay, because then, provided, and then now I come to this point again, provided the interaction between the X and the Y system is sufficiently small, then, I mean, this splitting, like I wrote it down in terms of the splitting of psi into one of these parts and one of these parts will at least, as long as the interaction stays small, be obeyed for some time.
This could be a description of the coherence in the same way. I mean, right, this is also orthogonality of parts of the wave function or something.
Yeah, but decoherence doesn't... I mean, on the one hand, I mean, for example, if you think about the Schrödinger's cat, I mean, you need decoherence to get rid of the cross terms, of the off-diagonal terms. Okay, and this is the same argument is used also there, that you say, okay, we have this microscopic disjoint support, that you only have the cat is dead or alive, and so there's nothing in between. But however, this what Bohmian mechanics adds to it is that you know the particles are either in one region or in the other region. So decoherence doesn't really help you to get out of the measurement problem because you still have the superposition. Decoherence basically only tells you, let's say you have two states, psi 1, psi 2, and decoherence helps you to, if they are microscopically disjoint, to say that the off-diagonal terms, psi 1 comma psi 2, are 0. But still, the superposition persists.
Because you're thinking of one observer overseeing the whole process from distance. But OK.
So in some sense, you can see this as the mathematical precise version of the collapse of the wave function. And basically, you get this only doing mathematics. So no philosophy here. Of course, I mean, we have assumed that the wave function of the universe was given. And I mean, this is also a degree of freedom that we don't know from the start, initial conditions where we don't have even less access to than the configuration of the particles in the universe. So the question, of course, remains, I mean, with what kind of wave function do we start? And what is the typical wave function? Okay, I mean, there are some ideas in that field, but it's, of course, quite hard. You can imagine to get a measure on the space of admissible wave function is a lot harder than to get a measure on configuration space. However, that needs to be done some time. However, for the practitioner again, we could say now that we know that, I mean, we can formulate Bohm mechanics for the universe, but we can break it down to the subsystems. Okay, we could also say, well, for all practical purposes, it's if this effective wave function phi exists at some time, and if it solves an autonomous Schrödinger equation, basically, then we could just guess the good initial state. And a good guess is, for example, take an eigenstate of a H atom or your ion trap or so on and so forth, and then start the dynamics from there only in the subsystem. So, of course, that might be already sufficient. So, however, now after this little detour, I'll get back to my question. I mean, what is the status of the wave function? So, I mean, the only ontological status that we gave to the degrees of freedom were to the configuration. We said the configuration really responds to particles being there at some instant of time. So you can ask the same question, of course. Now, not only for Q of t, but also for psi of t. So does psi of t have an ontological status? Or is it, for example, only there as a simple way to write down the dynamical law, the law of motion for QT, for example? The freedom of choice in choosing like this initial psi naught datum could just be a mathematical surplus, for example. And then basically, now this... these couple of points motivated us in looking a little bit into a formulation of a quantum theory which could be maybe done without a wave function. Because if you really look at it mathematically, what happens, you only need the values of psi really in the neighborhood of your configuration space trajectory to really write down the dynamics. So as, for example, in this region or on the wave function omega perp, I mean, particles will never roam into the support of that, and at least not in scales that are relevant for us for the experiment. Okay, so the question remains, I mean, is there some value of having psi defined in such a huge space, but pushing around only particles in the neighborhood of the trajectory that we're actually on? So there's a nice connection to Feynman's Nobel lecture speech, where he also raises this criticism in terms of for electrodynamics. But in electrodynamics, it's a lot easier to get rid of the fields. Basically, you can just, because the Maxwell fields really have sources at the positions of the particles, you can just integrate these Maxwell equations and have your Lenard-Wiechert fields, and then you can forget about the Maxwell equations. So it's different here in the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation doesn't have any sources. So we can't integrate out over the configuration space trajectory to guess the wave function. Okay. So now I think, so in some sense, Lee gave a talk from first principles to derive the basically quantum theory without the wave function. So I'll do it the other way around. Since we started with Bohm mechanics, well, I'll do some reverse engineering here that shows you a little bit how we could end up with a mechanical theory that involves only particles and not the wave function anymore. So here I spelled out for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. For example, I took a general Hamiltonian. So this x has just x1 to xn degrees of freedom. This qt is the convection space trajectory again. So we formulated Bohmian mechanics in the way given q0 and psi0, solving these equations gives you the solution of the theory. Now if you just separate, let's say, the modulus of psi and the phase of psi as two real functions, you can rewrite this whole system in a new way. Of course, the Schrödinger equation now splits up into two equations, one for the phase, one for the modulus. And you can also express basically qt as the gradient of the phase. Here, of course, you need initial data q0, s0, and r0.
So this is the same as this modulus?
Exactly. They are, so these equations are often used in quantum chemistry when integrating the Schrödinger equation, because there you would like to deal with real valued functions. And it's if you take this initial data and this initial data, then the solution spaces are exactly the same. However, if you take a little closer look, and that's actually also how Bohm himself wrote down the theory, maybe you cannot see it so easily by sight, but if you take another derivative here in the qt, so to not get a velocity but to get an acceleration, then you actually end up with this formula here. So we get the acceleration. So I forgot the masses. The mass has to be has to be on the left hand side. So so you get usually like the classical potential, as the minus the gradient of the classical potential, that is the force. And then you get another term, but this other term is only dependent on RT. So remember, RT squared is basically the same as psi t squared. Okay. And of course, you would have to add also the other two equations there. And then since we changed from the first order law to the second order law, we have to deliver not only this initial data, but we also have to constrain, of course, the velocities to really get the same solutions as above. And if the velocities at time zero fulfill that they're written as a gradient of the phase at zero, then we actually get exactly the same solutions. So, but now, I mean, since we want to get rid of the wave function, somehow here it looks already, if we would know the dynamics of the modulus of psi only, then we could somehow forget about these two equations and only use the first equation and say this is our new theory. So recall again this feature of Bohm mechanics which I refer to as equivariance. It can be restated, for example, in the following way. So if I have an ensemble of configurations, so not just one, but let's say n many, and m is sufficiently large. So really this ensemble is now in r to the 3n times m, okay, with an empirical distribution rho naught that if m tends to infinity approaches psi naught squared, which in our notation here is r naught squared basically. Then this empirical distribution by the Bohmian flux is transported to one at a time t, which is exactly psi t squared. Okay, so that means basically that if we would somehow sample our wave function or sample r of t now not only with at one point, but if you would spread a lot of these configurations throughout configuration space, then we could already tell somehow from the empirical distribution at the time t what RT should be. Okay? So instead of only having.
So the idea is to get rid of the RT, but this Q still stays in. So
this Q?
Which was the phase, this remains.
No, I want to get rid of both of these equations.
Oh.
So because, I mean, if you look at the first equation, there only RT enters. If somehow we had a method of guessing what RT is at the time T, we could forget about the other two equations. Now, the idea of guessing it is saying, well, instead of just taking one world, you take a lot of these worlds that sample the empirical distribution nice, with their empirical distribution sample psi t squared nicely. If we stay in the Bohmian trajectories or close to the Bohmian trajectories, I mean, the sampling will be good also over the time. Okay, that means that at any time t, if you move these guys, for example, with their Bohmian trajectories, then the empirical distribution will be psi t squared. Psi t squared is just the rt squared, which you could plug into the law above. So if
for the Bohmian trajectories, you need to know what the wave function.
Yeah, but I mean, okay. Let's say at time zero. At time zero, I distribute m configurations. Such that and m is so large that the empirical distribution is more or less already a psi zero squared. Okay, so that means I know psi naught squared, and psi naught squared is r naught squared.
Okay, I see. Okay, this will determine the time evolution
in a short step. So if you plug it in up there, you have the force, yes. The initial force, and then you go to the next time step. Now you stay close to the Bohmian trajectories, basically, because you take the right quantum force. So to this, the second term one usually refers to as quantum force. Okay, but since you stay close by this feature of equivariance, at the time step dt, let's say, 0 plus dt, you again psi dt squared distributed, the empirical distribution.
What a stupid question. This seems that the phase is irrelevant.
This seems like the phase is relevant, but it's hidden in the initial conditions. Okay, the closeness to the Bohmian trajectory is you only get if you start with the right velocities. If you start with any velocities, then it could be that there isn't even a function whose gradient gives me the velocities.
So the velocities encode the phase initially.
Exactly.
But this means also at a later time, the velocities still encode the phase of
exactly.
The Schrödinger
exactly.
Wave function if you compute it.
Exactly, yeah, and somehow forgetting, for example, the two equations completely, you could ask now, out of the positions and the velocities, can I somehow assemble a wave function, an effective wave function that really guides the system? I'll get to this in a second. So, and this is what Howard, Michael, and I then termed like the many interaction worlds approach. It's an approach because there are many versions possible at the moment, and basically we only gave a toy model. I think an extension you'll find in Lee's upcoming paper. I think so.
Sure.
But I mean,
inspired
yours.
By yours.
Pardon?
Definitely inspired by yours.
Thank you. So if you really now try to give this, I mean, so far it was just a mathematical trick. But now we want to give it an ontology. And the ontology is there's not only this one QT, but there are many QTs. Okay? In some sense, you could say it's nothing more than saying instead of only having 3n particles, we now have 3n times m particles. Okay? So we replace this RT squared by a function that now depends on all these configurations. And here I just say in quotation marks, we have to use some smooth version of the empirical distribution. Okay, and here you see, of course, there's a lot of degrees of freedom left. What I mean with smooth empirical distribution, or smoothened out empirical distribution, and there actually it turns out that you can take really a lot of versions of this. I mean, we need smoothness because we want to compute gradients and so on. And there are many versions that, in the limit m to infinity, really converge to psi t squared. But however, of course, if you're far away from m to infinity, then there might be quite some differences. So the equation of motions are then simply that. I just copied the equation that we had above and replaced r now by a function of all these configurations. And basically, you can now see it. You have two terms. One term is the usual Newton force for a classical potential. And the other term is this new quantum force. But this quantum force is really determined by the actual configuration that we have, okay, by the empirical distribution. somehow this divides these particles. So you can have the following view that, I mean, these are not many interacting worlds, but in principle, these are just three n times m particles. Okay, but the dynamical law differentiates between these particles. Namely, some particles only interact with their own cloud somehow, and but another term basically says that they are also interacting with the other clouds, and you'll see that all the classical effects, I mean that's pretty obvious, come only from the interaction with their somehow cloud or world or whatever you want to name it. And all the quantum effects arise actually from this red term. So again, given the initial data, Q naught and Q naught dot, the positions and the velocities configurations, you'll get the solutions. You could say, in contrast to Everett's interpretation, where the splitting of the worlds has something to do with splitting into orthogonal components of the wave function, I mean, we rather have n times m matter points. And those are really differentiated by what I just said, by only the dynamical law. So, so while each of these worlds moves deterministically, we don't know in which world we really live. So probabilistic assertions arise naturally. And one of the easiest ways to write, for example, something down like an expectation value would be we take the equal weight on all the worlds and say whenever we have some function that is that depends on this special configuration which we're in, we just sum equally weighted over all the possible worlds that are there at time t. So just to show that, I mean, this is not too far away from quantum mechanics, and we can at least show that, I mean, solutions of Bohm mechanics can be described by solutions of this many interacting worlds approach. For example, let's say a psi t, or a solution of the Schrödinger equation, is given, and let's denote, for example, the Bohmian trajectory with initial datum q naught as a mapping t to qt of q naught. And then we can arrange for a solution of the many world interpretation. Let's call it qtm, where m is the label of the world, basically, such that we'll in the end, I'll show this in a second, we'll get exactly the same moments or expectation values, variances, like in quantum mechanics. So in the two conditions that we have to fulfill, that we have an MIW solution that is close to Bohm mechanics, is the following. Of course, we need that our distribution of the particles, or like the smooth version of the empirical distribution of the particles, is close to psi naught squared. And we also need that the initial velocities are chosen in the right way with respect to the wave function. Then, as we discussed a little bit before, one can convince oneself quite easily that the actual trajectories of MIW are basically, at least in the limit m to infinity, the same as the one from Bohmian mechanics. So in using that, you can just write down the expectation value that we have defined as sum over the equally weighted worlds, okay, where we plug in the solution of the MIW approach. Then by star, we can replace that, of course, by the Bohmian trajectories in the limit, of course, or in the regime of M being large, neglecting all the errors. That's why I write here approximate. Then, of course, I mean, these are distributed, so the initial data is distributed with respect to psi naught squared, so I can make also like a continuous version out of this expectation value. And then by equivariance of Bohmian mechanics, I mean, we can shift this time evolution by the flux of Bohmian mechanics into the Schrödinger evolution, and we end up with this, and that tells us that we basically get exactly the same expectation values. Of course, by the same argument, also variances and higher moments as in quantum mechanics. So if these two conditions are fulfilled, then, as I said, we get a good agreement with quantum theory, here with the interpretation of Bohmian mechanics. And Bohmian mechanics can basically be seen as some kind of continuum limit, some hydrodynamic limit of this many interacting world approach. However, if these two conditions are not fulfilled, then we can end up with solutions, of course, that are quite different from quantum behavior. So basically, the problem is, if we would do this the other way around, I mean, for example, we could ask, is any solution, or for any solution of the many interacting world approach, can I describe this somehow in the limit of m to infinity by means of a wave function? Then, of course, you have to see if at some time, some initial time, for example, you can really fulfill these two conditions. I mean, that's, of course, easily. I mean, you just compute the modulus of the wave function by the empirical distribution. However, to get really to that, you have to integrate once, and therefore you have to fulfill some integrability condition. And that doesn't have to be satisfied, especially when you think of the part of these M worlds like a gas, like a classical gas. You would, for example, expect that you have a Maxwell distribution, and these velocities can actually vary a lot. And this condition might not be so easy to be fulfilled. We, at the moment, hope that for typical, so if you do a typicality analysis like we did for Bohm mechanics, then we hope to find that for typical initial conditions, this will not be the case. And that for typical MIW solutions, we'll always be able to say that there's a wave function which is quite close, which gives basically the similar predictions. So just to note a couple of similar approaches. So Holland, Poirier, and especially also Charles Sevens, they had quite similar ideas where, so basically Sevens, I think he's a philosopher. He came up with very similar ideas, but didn't really pose a model. However, he has nice ideas on how to incorporate spin and so on and so forth. So really, he really had, I would say, he worked on that topic more or less on exactly the same time that we worked on it. And we exchanged a lot of emails and a lot of preprints with each other. So that his publication is a little bit after our publication is only due to the peer review process. Then the other publications are basically in quantum chemistry. They don't have a model that has discrete number of worlds, but a continuous version of it. But more or less go in the same direction. I mean, we were not aware of these things before we did our work. Then, of course, there's this nice connection to this maximal variety principle, which was shown to us yesterday by Lee. And yeah, I hope a lot more works will be added to that topic. So I want to end now by giving a little example candidate. I mean, so far I only said like replace RT squared by a smoothed version of the empirical distribution. I just want to give you an example for a toy model in one dimension, how this RT could look like. So if you have one dimension, only one particle per world, like the simplest thing you can do, we can write down an ordering. We could order our worlds at Q1 is the one on the left, and Qm is the one on the right. Then we can guess the RT basically by saying, well, I mean, our expectation value in the end should, of course, have something to do with the continuous version where RT squared is the density, okay? So if you take the right-hand side and then split it up in intervals that go from Qm minus 1 to Qm, okay, we find in the limit m to infinity, of course, the tails are forgotten here, but the tails will be small if you have many, many of these Qms. Then we can approximate by this expression. And if you just linearize the integral, then we get this, of course, from the boundary. And then we just take, for example, the value for the x to be Qm. And then we can simply see that if we look at the formula we started with on the left-hand side, that if we choose this r squared to be 1 over m, divided by this distance here. This is positive because these guys are ordered. Then we have a nice candidate for the RT. Of course, then if you want to plug it into the law of motion, and I mean, here we have to evaluate the derivative. Also in defining the U, we have to evaluate the derivative. If you do really the simplest thing that you would do, namely just linearization of these derivatives, you end up basically with this term here, that this U can be given as the sum over differences over 1 over the distances between the particles. So this is, I think, exactly the same formula that you showed us yesterday, only in one dimension, right?
Actually, it's not. It's just by a sign.
It's a minus sign? Okay. I didn't catch that yesterday.
It's almost the same formula, but it differs by a sign.
Okay.
But nonetheless, we have the leading term and derivatives of rho or r squared. It's both at the same term.
Okay.
But also, you want to minimize, not maximize, or whatever you want.
Well, that's why, I don't know if you heard my talk, that's why I had to put a minus sign to the potential.
Yeah, actually, I mean, so this term, I mean, just to get an idea of what this quantum potential usually does is, so whenever two worlds, for example, approach each other, okay, then usually, I mean, the empirical density should get a little bump. So we know from the Schrodinger equation that basically the Laplacian really fights these little bumps and wants to relax them again. So this is exactly what happens here. I mean, these guys measure somehow. Yeah, I mean, here in the continuous version, there's usually a Laplace of R divided by R, which the Laplace measures basically the curvature of the density. And whenever some curvature occurs, this potential switches on and tries to get these particles apart from each other. From this effect, basically, one gets the...
Is there a difference for bosons and fermions?
I mean, honestly, we haven't really looked into the statistics. I would say, I mean, the analysis up to here don't really depend on so much on whether you can permute these configurations or not. Okay, I would say it becomes quite interesting when you really want to have something that is, for example, spinner valued. You want to describe, like say, let's say a Schrodinger equation that, or a Dirac equation, for example, that's spinner valued. So I think for the statistics, I think you can also get to this point here. Okay, then maybe just to close, I mean, just to see that I mean, this is all not completely fiction. We started with this usual double slit experiment and asked us if our equation of motion is really capable of reproducing interference. And so we started with two little Gaussians that are a little bit separated. On the left-hand side, you see basically an interpolated histogram of all the trajectories that we computed. Here of, I think, 40 worlds or something like that. And here you see the exact one coming from the exact analytically known trajectories of Bohmian mechanics. So, I mean, we can also display it here in terms of the trajectories. So you see these guys are really quite similar. And although it doesn't seem to be, it's not really apparent from this law of motion, things like interference and so on can be really reproduced, at least here in these pictures qualitatively. So coming back to the question, so can we do without psi t? I would say yes. In these toy models, for example, I mean, it's clear that we can. But the cost is quite high, namely this introduction of these many worlds, so which is personally, I would say, in my opinion, even a little bit too high. However, it's an interesting question to ask. I mean, under which conditions can we give up the psi t? And there are, of course, a lot of things to be done. I mean, we would like to study the model in 3D. We'd like to introduce somehow spin and also statistics, then relativistic equation of motion, and so on and so forth. But I think the main part of the program that will really decide if this is successful or not will be a statistical analysis of subsystems. Basically, can we, for example, always reproduce these two conditions, Roman 1 and 2. But here I think I have to stop because your seminar is. All right. You're relieved already.
I'm hosting it.
Of course, of course. Thank you for coming.
But you're here until tomorrow.
Until tomorrow at around 2, I think I'll leave.
Yeah, I'd like to. I'm still gonna catch you around.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes.
So that was interesting. So just let me see if I understand the way you cash out the notion of probabilities, basically by counting these worlds. So if you had a situation where, you know, a two-level system or something, so there's only two possible ontological realities, and it isn't 50-50, it's like 70-30 or something. In order to make sense of it in these terms, would you have to have multiple exact copies of each kind just to get the balance right?
So you're saying you have a configuration space where particles can only be at position minus one and position plus one.
Right.
Okay, then you would have 50 worlds on the left side and 50 worlds on the right side, for example. I mean, to get this problem.
What if it were the probabilities were such that it was 70% chance that you're in the left one?
And then 70 worlds would be left.
So you'd need 70 identical copies of the
Exactly, program. Yeah. I mean, here the probabilities really enter in this very Laplacian sense of probabilities. You just count and normalize, basically. And yeah, so I mean, the nice feature is I think just that, I mean, if you compare to Everettian views and so on, I mean, here there's no splitting, there's no, I mean, probabilities are assigned to histories in a very natural way, in this Laplacian way, basically. And what really decides for the particles to be counted into one world and the other worlds is not that they are from the beginning painted blue and red and so on and so forth. But I mean, they are all particles in a sense, but some, basically the law of motion differentiates between those particles in one world and those particles in another world. So one shouldn't really look at it as one really has distinct worlds. But only because of the dynamics you can distinguish the worlds, or the particles belonging to, let's say, cloud A and cloud B, or so on and so forth. Yes?
So one of the things you said about Bayesian mechanics was that there's like these bits of the wave function that are important for the particle trajectories. But if I'm sitting in one of these worlds, isn't it, by the same token, true that it's only the worlds that are nearby configuration space that are going to have any effect on me?
No. Here in the law, actually, I mean, in the potential, it's really a function of all the worlds, all the times. So, I mean, in Bohmian mechanics, I mean, there can be places of the wave function which are really empty, because you have only one configuration traveling around. In this multi-interacting world approach, I mean, you have these M configurations. They are there for all times. And that could also happen that maybe, I mean, a few worlds travel into some remote location, a configuration space. But however, they don't really, in your probability estimates, so basically, they don't appear so much because the weight is so small. Okay, but you could, of course, I mean, in some sense, in this theory, I mean, the best guess that we can make about a prediction is like this weighted sum over all the worlds, because we don't know in which one we live. But of course, we could live in on this very, very tail configuration that for which it would be actually appear a little bit differently.
I was thinking more just like you do like a normal measurement. And there's now like two macroscopically distinct possibilities, say. And then you look at the outcome of the measurement. Okay, so now you know you're in the half of the worlds that are where it came out, spit out.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And now, why should I care at all about those worlds where it came out, spin down? Like, because they're not going to have any effect in my future.
Okay, but here we have to distinguish. I mean, you're talking about an experiment that's done in one world repetitively, for example, like a coin flip or something like that. Okay, so that will require a different analysis.
I just mean one experiment.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a difference between saying, I mean, for example, like in Bohm mechanics, I mean, the first measure, the psi t squared we introduced, that is basically only to filling our ignorance on which trajectory the universe actually is. But you're asking a different question. You're asking the question, in this one universe that I am in, I'm performing an experiment, and I want to know about the relative frequencies of outcomes and measurements of this one experiment. So what you have to do is you, this first measure doesn't tell you anything about these subsystems of your universe. What you have to do is a statistical analysis of the subsystems, like I tried to show in Bohm mechanics. So, and so far in this theory, somehow this this Laplacian probability that comes out here in this many worlds theory, that corresponds to this psi t squared. Okay, that's a measure of on the level of universes, basically. However, if you want to talk about experiments, then there is another analysis that really waits to be done, namely really to say, okay, now we are in one world, and we do an experiment in this one world. It's not like that you set up the experiment on n different worlds and then compare the outcomes of that. That would be given by this weighted, this equally weighted sum, okay? But we want to say something about the one world we are in. And so far, the only thing that we can say is once, so if we have these initial conditions such that we are close to the Bohm mechanics, we can use the analysis of Bohm mechanics to do the statistics of the subsystem. However, if we are away from Bohm mechanics, at the moment there's not a clue what we can actually say about an experiment. Is this distinction clear between you have really some one measure on hypothetical universes, and then you have a measure for your subsystems? Okay, these are really two distinct things. So here, this first measure, or some sense, this expectation value I showed here is really on all the universes. Okay, that doesn't even say something about your experiment. Okay. All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks.